Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Listening to Sam in the Morning with Jen, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to the show. It is on Monday, March 23rd.
Good morning.
We're back. Good morning, Jen. We have a great show for you today. We have a guest waiting in the wings in a few minutes. And we have a beautiful day in LA.
We do.
Although, did you hear about a couple people? Why is like the sound weird for me? I don't know. But at any rate, did you hear this thing in the news? There were a couple of guys, I guess, on Pacific Coast Highway, and they were driving down the one, you know, where it's very scenic and everything. Mm-hmm. And you know how there's like outlooks and stuff, you stop, and well, they were standing in one outlook, and it collapsed.
Oh, no.
Do you believe it? I mean, like a mudslide type of
wow.
thing.
Wow. No, I didn't even hear about
that. And one died, one was injured. So that's pretty bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, so we have beautiful weather and everything, but you never know what's going to happen to you here. It's very uncertain to live here in California.
Yikes. That's pretty crazy. I was actually on the PCH many times yesterday. So
really?
Yeah. I didn't stop and like look out, but I did hike Temescal Canyon, and then I was with my family in the Palisades.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Where did you hike now?
Temescal Canyon.
Where is that at?
The Palisades.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Is it pretty cool?
It's pretty.
Yeah?
It's not my favorite hike.
No.
It was nice.
Yeah.
It's nice to switch it up, though. So
yeah, I'll have to check it out.
The same hike.
I know. There's also a lot of nice hikes in the, like on the way to Malibu from here, you know, like the Santa Monica Mountains and
yes.
stuff. And there's a lot of places to go there. I need to do that more often. And I think now is the best time to do it before it gets too hot.
Yes, definitely.
Right?
It was pretty hot yesterday. I'm not going to lie.
It was pretty hot?
Yeah. It was like painfully hot.
Wow.
But we also went kind of like 1 o'clock, 1:30 in the afternoon.
Oh, wow. So that's smart.
That's like the hottest time.
Yeah.
But that's all that worked out. So
yeah.
We had
It's funny it was hot because I was in Redondo Beach yesterday at around 1.
What were you doing down there?
Went to a brunch with family, and that was fun. And we sat at the Cheesecake Factory on the in the marina there. So it was pretty cool, but it was so packed, man. I can't even tell you. One restaurant must have had like 1,000 people there. I don't
Yikes.
Know how many. There was a lot of people.
That is a lot of people.
Yeah. So the weather there was just sort of like perfect, you know, but it was a little, I mean, it was a little chilly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I don't understand how it was that hot. But you guys were in the sun constantly.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then when I was biking later, I went bike riding with my uncle and my cousin, and it was really cold.
Really?
Yeah, that was around like 4.
Where did you go, on the beach?
No, up in the Bluffs in Malibu. I mean, in the Palisades.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I need to start biking again, man. My bike's been sitting around. I mean, I need to put air in the tires because it's been sitting around since last summer. Yeah, because in the winter, it doesn't really appeal to me to ride a bike. You know, it's just cold.
Yeah.
And it gets dark early and things like that. But in the summer, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It really is. I love riding a bike. And yesterday, I guess I didn't even know, while I was in Redondo, they had like a whole like massive bike ride here in the valley on Ventura Boulevard. And I felt, damn, I missed out on that, you know, because I want to join like a bike club or something to meet some new people, you know, who also like to ride. But, you know, usually these things are like, you know, they get all the really advanced people. So I'm going to have to find something for beginners, because I just, you know, I don't ride to ride fast or to be, you know, in better shape than anybody else. I just ride to cruise. So my bike riding is something like riding the path in Santa Monica.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's pretty cool. There's people that go rollerblading there, too.
Yeah.
Do you do that? Have you ever rollerbladed?
I have not rollerbladed there, because I retired my rollerblades many years ago. I haven't had them since. But I've definitely gone bike riding there. It's just too I think riding there though is like too crowded, because you're like, I'm not skilled enough to like break and like know how to maneuver around all these people that like cross the path or stop short. Like I just didn't even know what to do. I'd probably hurt myself.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's people crossing the path all the time. Wow. I mean, haven't you ridden bike before in your life?
Yeah, but I haven't.
You haven't in a long
yesterday
time.
Yesterday was the first time in probably 12 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, so I ride a stationary bike, but that's, you don't have to brake or like worry about balance.
That's quite the same.
No, huh? And there's no like oncoming traffic. You're just stationary. So it's a little different.
Yeah. Did you see any good movies this weekend?
No.
Yeah.
Did not go to the movie theater.
I was watching on Netflix, the Wolf of Wall Street again. I saw it in the movies when it came out, but it's worth seeing a second time.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
I mean, it's a great movie.
I loved it.
Great acting, funny. It's got all the ingredients, you know?
Yeah.
So I understand that there's a new movie with a woman that was his wife in the movie, right? She was really beautiful, blonde.
Mm-hmm.
She's got a new movie, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the one with Will Smith.
Yeah, Focus. Okay.
Yeah, I need to see that. Have you seen it yet?
No.
Yeah. It got some terrible reviews, but...
I still don't know what it's about.
Yeah.
I've seen the trailer probably 100 times, and I have no idea what it's about.
I think it's about a heist or something. I think they're like...
Right, but like, okay, thieves. We've seen that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Seen that, done that, huh?
Right. I don't know. Sometimes movies get made, and I'm still curious how.
Yeah, huh?
Yeah.
I know. I just wanted to bring up, you know, I just finished another book on ISIS, and I got to tell you, there's in the headline saying that Americans are increasingly concerned about ISIS. Now they're saying that about 80% of Americans think ISIS poses a serious problem. I don't know where the government is on this, but apparently they don't feel like that. And I just, and I'm telling you, I read all the history about them and everything, and, you know, all I'm coming away from this is... this is like, you know, I liken this to like, let's say you're in a big store, okay? And there's a kid, a little brat, coming in, and he starts doing whatever he wants, breaks everything, throws everything on the floor, and people are just standing by and looking. Nobody's doing a thing. And that's what they're doing. I mean, they're doing whatever they want. Nobody's stopping them. Why would they stop? So they kill, they take over. And what you have to understand also is that they have a lot of sympathy in the Muslim world, because in many places they go and they actually institute like order, you know, in places that there isn't any because of the war in Syria. So, you know, they build some infrastructure and things like that, so people convert to their side. So somebody's gonna come from the outside and stop this. And I just don't believe that we're the biggest power in the world and we're so intimidated by them that we're not doing a thing. And not only us, I mean, there should be a coalition there of many countries, but how can the world just sit by and wait for this threat to increase so much? You know what I'm saying?
No, because isn't there a U.S.-led coalition, and aren't there many countries?
Well,
involved?
But I'm telling you, it's like it's only airplanes. I think the only thing I've heard of is American planes. But you can't win
and
a
Jordan
war from
was
the
involved.
Air. Well, I mean,
and Japan was involved.
I mean, do you see anybody slowing them down? I don't see anything happening.
I don't know that I see it,
you
but
need
I do hear
a war.
About it in the news often, and I would guess there's stuff being done about it. I can't imagine that there's. We know everything.
Jen, there's nothing being done about it. I'm telling you. I mean, look, it's been a couple of years. The thing is, they're an offshoot of Al-Qaeda, you know. So the thing is that there's no... It's not going to get better. It's just going to get worse. And they're killing a lot of people. And they have designs on the Middle East and everything. And they're not going to stop. I mean, unless somebody stops them, you know. And I don't know. I'm just saying, Jen. I'm just saying, because if they start attacking us and things like that, you know, dirty bombs, whatever, we're in deep doo-doo, you know?
Yes.
So let's just stand up to the enemy and do whatever it takes, you know? If I was young enough, I'd go fight, I think.
You left Israel. Would you really go back and, like, I don't know, is fighting your thing?
No, not at all. But I mean, I didn't leave because I didn't want to go to the army. I left because my dad sent me out at 16, sent me off, and because he had designs on moving to America, so he sent me first. But I don't, you know. I mean, look, if I lived there, I would have gone and probably would have been okay with it. But yeah, I'm very difficult with taking orders from people. So, you know, I don't know that I would have been a great soldier.
Maybe it would have, you know, changed you.
Yeah, maybe not. I don't know. Yeah, changed me for the worse. I can't imagine. I had a conversation about it yesterday with someone. And like I've said before here, I think in the military they take you and they deconstruct you and build you back as a fighting machine. And in Israel it happens to each and every one of them.
Yeah.
So, you know, what can you do? Anyway, I just I saw this. Oh, I guess there, we were talking about bringing back the X-Files, but I don't know. I didn't really read the article, so I don't know what it is. But Pretty Woman is 25 years old, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Do we care? Not really.
I do. I like that movie.
Yeah? But do you care that it's 25?
It's kind of... I'm 30. So yeah. When I think of a movie in terms of that it's 25 years old and like it's been probably a part of my life, almost my whole life.
Right.
That I think that's kind of cool.
So you watch it early in your life, would you say?
Not when I was 5, but right. Yes.
But maybe 10?
Yeah.
Come on. I mean, that's about a prostitute.
No, I mean, but every girl has a Pretty Woman moment. I mean, I even had brunch at the Beverly Wilshire the other day with friends and I was like, I'm Pretty Woman. Should we go in Escada and like tell them like... Big mistake. Huge. Like, everyone knows that line.
Yeah.
So, I just think that it's, like, I don't know, iconic in its way.
I know. But, I mean, it's almost like when girls tell you that, I grew up always wanting to be in Playboy. And that's like, what little girl thinks about these things? You know, but some do.
That's not what I took from the movie. What I took from it is like the romantic story of how you can be anything. And
I'm sure,
because
you're a woman
charming.
And women look for that kind of stuff.
Right.
To me, it's like she's a hooker, you know? It's not for kids.
No, so it's definitely not for kids. But she changes her ways and he loves her for
that's
whatever
true.
She is. And they end up happily ever after. That's not the original ending, but that is what happened.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you know? What was the original ending then?
It was like a way darker version of that where I think they don't end up together and she goes back to prostitution or something.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I guess that would be the alternative ending. Huh?
Yeah. That was the original and then they changed it.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The audiences probably didn't like it, huh?
Probably. Happy endings are
They
way
wanted
more
a happy
fun.
Ending. Let's fall in love.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to talk about stories and everything with our guest who we're going to bring in now. And we have Lisa Doctor in the studio. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Thank you. So tell us a little bit about what it is that you do, Lisa.
Well, I was a movie executive for many years. And then when I left about 15 years ago, I took the best of the job with me, which is working with writers. So I became a teacher and love doing that. And a teacher here in L.A., and then I moved it to the rest of the world.
Really?
It's been great fun, yeah.
How did you do that?
Well, I was offered an opportunity at the University of the Balearic Islands in Mallorca to teach English to students who were studying English, but it wasn't English language, it was creative writing, which is very rare in Spain. So
even in their own language?
It was in English. They were
No, but is it rare in Spain to have creative writing? I wouldn't say, right?
Less rare in their own language than it's an unusual way to teach the English language.
Yeah.
So what I did, I had a wonderful group. The class was sold out, so I was very pleased about the interest level.
Yeah.
And what I did was I took a lot of the exercises that I used in America.
Uh-huh.
Excuse me. In America with American writers, with English-speaking writers, I developed hundreds of exercises to help them deepen their protagonists and deepen their own experience with writing. And I handed it over to these new speakers of English. And the results were remarkable. They loved it. And their English just sort of took off because their confidence level took off.
Yeah.
So I decided to put it into a book. And that's the book that's going to be out on Thursday.
Oh, so that's a book you brought us, right? And we'll talk all about it and stuff. But it's a brand new book, huh?
Brand new, hasn't come out yet. It's still in pre-order.
Wow.
And hit number one in its category on Amazon last week.
Really? So congratulations. Crazy. Before
Thank
even
you.
Being published.
Yes,
huh?
With no reviews or anything, just interest level.
Wow.
Just getting the word out.
So you touched a nerve with creative writers. I mean, people that want to write would benefit from this book. And we'll talk about it.
Surely.
So when you were a movie executive, how did you get into that?
When I moved out here from New York in the late 70s, I know this sounds crazy, but I fell into a job working with a brand new actor named Sylvester Stallone, who had a movie out called Rocky about 3 weeks out. So it was instant stardom. I was working with his personal managers. And my job was, as an assistant, I was right out of school. I was 23 years old. And all these scripts kept coming in for Mr. Stallone. And they said, would you like to read scripts for him? And I said, sure. I had never done it. But this was the 70s where things just sort of happened. And I was put into an office and handed piles of scripts, most of them dealing with sports and the mafia, two of my least favorite subjects to work with. But there I was. And as a result of that, I became a creative executive at Universal Pictures in the late 70s. And it moved from there. I went to a production company at Warner Brothers after that, a bunch of independent companies, back to Warner Brothers, and TriStar twice. And then my last executive job, I ran Robin Williams' company at TriStar.
Very cool. Yes. Now, so you're originally from New York, right?
I am,
but you've been
Queens.
Here a long time.
1976, yes, after college.
Mm-hmm. Wow, 76, that's when I came to the States. That was the bicentennial year. Do you remember that?
Very, very well.
Wow.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, 200 years of 4th of July, and I arrived here, I think. Well, I left Israel on the 4th of July. I arrived here a few days later because I stopped off in Europe. But I remember that year. It was a cool year. So in 76, you moved to L.A. What made you decide to move?
Well, my husband at the time, I'm remarried, we had met in college in New York, and then we're at the University of Chicago, where he received his master's degree in English. He went on to become the president of Universal Pictures, so we both sort of got into the movie business at the same time. And we found ourselves working for movie stars when we came out here. Back then, it wasn't as difficult to do as it probably is now.
Right.
He was working for Warren Beatty on Heaven Can Wait. He was his assistant. And I was working for Sly Stallone, so it was very cool.
So, but what background did you guys have that qualified you to do this?
What were you doing
at the time?
We were young. We were in our early 20s. We basically had college degrees and a master's degree for him. And my first job was, I was an assistant in a communications company, and I got the job with Stallone's managers through an employment agency that's,
really?
I'm sure, defunct for decades.
Yeah.
And I walked in and they hired me. My boss was from the Bronx and I'm from Queens. And, you know, we sort of, in a tribal way, understand each other. And he said, you want the job, it's yours. And then all these scripts kept coming in for Stallone. So I started reading them. This is many, many years ago.
Yeah.
It's a distant memory now, but I do remember it clearly.
But it's an experience in your life, you know. So when you had your degrees, were you like already qualified to do writing, professional writing?
What I don't know what one is qualified for when one is right out of school, but back then it wasn't as competitive. The world was a little bit different.
Yeah, and there were less people, right?
There were so many less people in the world and in Los Angeles.
Yeah,
and there were jobs aplenty, or so it seemed.
Right.
Maybe it was just incredible blind luck for the two of us. But
amazing.
But there we were. Yeah,
amazing.
It was kinda crazy.
So you guys discovered each other and realized you have similar background, similar interests. He's into writing as well? Your husband or
my
was?
Ex-husband.
Your ex-husband.
Yes, he was a writer for a while and then moved into working at Universal Pictures and climbed the ladder, became president of production.
Wow. And what did he start as at Universal?
Creative executive as well.
Really?
But years after me. I was already way gone into other jobs when he came in the 90s.
I see. Okay. So it was possible to actually enter it. Maybe entry level and actually build up to be president of the company.
Yes, I like to believe it's still possible. There are probably more people, you know, sort of getting in the way and elbowing their way through.
Yes.
But
Well, one of my best friends is a VP of development at a production company too, and she started as an assistant at one of the agencies, the talent agencies, and then she's done a similar path to that.
Yeah. I'm glad.
So she's working her way up.
Good. It still happens. My daughter's manager of production at Sony at Screen Gems. I'm very proud of her.
Oh, very nice. So it stayed in the family.
Yes. Well, with my daughter, my son's an engineer, mechanical engineer, working with renewable energy. I'm very proud of him too.
Really? Yes. Well, I'm sure. So, I mean, they were born to an intellectual. Why not, you know?
Why not? A little plug for the kids.
Exactly.
Proud mother.
So for college, you went to the University of Chicago, or was that for your master's degree?
He got his master's there. I was just taking classes. We went to State University of New York at Stony Brook as undergraduates.
I see. Okay. And did you take writing in college?
I did. I studied history of theater, starting back from ancient Greek theater up till what was considered very modern in the 70s, which was Neil Simon. And now that would be considered ancient plays, I suppose.
Yeah.
So, of course, I was always interested in working with writers. Mm. And that's what I've been doing for the last 38 years.
Very cool. So did you grow up knowing that's what you wanted to do?
I did. And I just had a guest blog on a website that was about when did the love of reading begin.
Uh-huh.
It went live on the internet this week.
And you have to love reading in order to be able to like writing.
You
and
do.
Be good at it.
Yes, but I didn't grow up in that culture. My father dropped out of the ninth grade and was, I don't want to say functionally illiterate, but reading wasn't part of his life, just sort of making a living as a dress cutter was. And my mother was a cashier in a hospital and did not really emphasize reading in our home. It was just something that I absolutely loved from a very small child. I was actually teaching kids in first grade.
Really?
How to read because I already knew how. Yeah, I just always loved it. And I dreamed of being a writer, and I didn't know that development executives existed when I was a little kid, especially growing up in New York.
Right.
But once I found out that there was actually a job where you could, you know, sort of guide writers, I was all over it. I loved it. And that's why I took the best of what my job was and created a new career, my post-40 career, which is already more than 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm still doing it. And I have the energy. I want to continue doing it.
Yeah. So you chose to move to L.A. Why? Because you knew you wanted to be in the movie industry?
Yes, he wanted to. And I thought, sure, why not?
I had never been to movies.
Yeah, I hadn't been west of Pennsylvania until I had gone to Chicago, and then I hadn't been west of Illinois. So it was a real shock, and I still love it every day. And my husband now, who's a psychologist, is a native Californian, and he loves everything that the West Coast is.
Yeah,
as do I.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. So you have two offspring?
I do.
Awesome. And so one is an engineer. The other one, what did you say she was?
She's a manager of production at Sony Pictures at Screen Gems.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So look, it's a family thing.
It's right. A family thing.
Yeah. Is it true, though, that sometimes people succeed because of who they know in the industry here? I mean, somebody can, like, get a good position and maybe not know what the hell they're doing?
Yes, but they have to sustain it. And it's been my experience over the years that I have seen nepotism, of course. I wasn't a product of it, but I did see it. I didn't have any contacts at all when I came out here. But what I found was that those who didn't have what it takes to keep it going usually didn't last because one has to really sort of stay on top of one's game.
Right.
In it, it's a fast-moving business, and it helps to really know what you're doing.
Right. Wow. So you worked with Stallone, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, did you have any part of the writing of the movie, Rocky?
No, but I was the first person, as far as I know, to read Rocky 2.
Really?
And, yes, he handed it to me and he said, tell me how many hankies you use after you finish reading it. He was really funny. He had a great sense of humor. I mean, I'm sure he still has. I haven't seen him in many years.
Right.
But I would just sort of have the scripts sort of appear on my desk. Some of them he wrote, and most of them were submissions.
Right.
But he wrote quite a number of them.
And it's amazing that he wrote, right? Because we don't look at him as an intellectual or as an educator.
I didn't know he wrote at all.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
he's
most of
many,
his
many
movies, right?
Yes.
He wrote most of his movies.
Yes, and was really a fine writer. But, you know, I could always tell sometimes the scripts would come in without a name on it so that I would be more sort of objective.
Right.
But I always knew because he had a certain writing style. There was a signature that was in there in his writing. So I always knew when he was the author of the screenplay.
Yeah. Now, so you were reading the screenplay in what capacity? Why did he give you the screenplay to read?
I was working with his personal managers.
Uh-huh.
So we were looking at material that we could then sort of partner up with producers and have them developed at major studios.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So it's very different working with... Twice I worked with movie stars, once with Stallone and once with Robin Williams. And it's a little bit different working with the star. It's a lot easier because you can get a lot of material through the channels more quickly, of course, when there's a major star attached to the project. But with Robin, not everything that we developed was for him to star in. Some of it was just material that he wanted to produce.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
And you had mentioned earlier that you worked on Mrs. Doubtfire.
I did. It was so much fun.
Really?
Yeah, I grew up with that. My cousins can literally quote every single line in that movie. And I never know what they're saying. And then they're like, oh, it's Mrs. Doubtfire, Jen. Yeah. Get with it. I'm like, I know that he got hit in the back of the head with a fruit or something, or somebody got...
yes, the walk-by fruiting.
Right, exactly.
I don't remember much about it, you know.
Yes,
but
we shot that at the Claremont Hotel in Berkeley. Yeah.
Really? Mm. So you were part of the production as well, right? I mean, you were
I worked... The movie was shot up in the Bay Area in San Francisco, in the environs of San Francisco, and I was here at TriStar Picture mostly developing new material, looking for new material, but every week or so I would go up and be on set and meet mostly with Robin's wife at the time, Marcia, who was producing the film.
Oh, she was producing the film
at the
time.
Yes, she produced the film.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. So whatever happened, did he, like, get divorced and remarry?
Yes.
He remarried, right?
He did.
I'm asking Jen, like, you know the pop culture things.
I don't know relationship history for people usually, but
he did remarry.
He remarried.
He did.
And he's got kids too, right?
Three, yes.
Three kids?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. He was such an amazing man, you know. I mean, wonderful. I remember he came into the scene. I'm sure he was, like, probably in the stand-up circuit and things like that before. But he came into the scene in Mork and Mindy, and I thought, what a talented guy. And I'm sure I'm not the only one. He came in, and he was totally different from everybody else. Right?
Yes.
He was all over the place. He had his own comedy. He was doing a lot of ad-lib.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny.
And a different man when he wasn't performing. He was very contemplative, very, as many comedians are, very quiet,
right.
A very deep thinker, and an amazingly generous man.
Yeah.
If someone said, I like your shirt, he would literally take it off and say, it's yours.
Wow.
Amazing. So
chew off all his body hair, right?
Yes,
he's known as very hairy.
Yes, I remember that challenge in Mrs. Doubtfire when we needed to shoot his hands up close and... they had to be a woman's hands.
Oh, no.
Oh, wow. He's done a lot of movies, huh? But that's the thing. You said he's got a serious side, and he's done a lot of dramas that were amazing also.
Yes, he was. You know, he studied at Juilliard. An extraordinary man, totally missed around the world.
Yeah.
And when he passed away, I received so many notes of, you know, I hadn't seen him in many, many years. But people were touched really everywhere. People
right.
I know from so many countries loved him for good reason. He was a very lovable soul.
Yeah,
yeah,
definitely.
Mm.
Well, we miss him all.
Yes.
And it's nice to still see people post about him and everything.
Oh,
you know,
yes.
It's very cool. So let's talk a little bit about writing. So you wrote a book called Accidental Poetry, Improve Your English Through Creative Writing.
Yes.
And actually, we probably should get to this... I just wanted to ask you, you were in the movie business and everything.
Yes.
And did you retire from it at a certain point?
Well, I think the movie business retires people
before
they have
huh?
a chance to retire.
Wow. Well,
I had turned 40, and I know this sounds crazy, but at 40, I was the oldest person doing what I was doing, which was being a development executive. Everybody was half my age at that point. And I thought, wow, this is quite amazing.
Yeah.
A little depressing. So at my 40th birthday party, it was a surprise party, one of the guests was the executive producer of General Hospital, and I wasn't, you know, I didn't have time to watch soap operas. I never really watched them, but I was interested in them as an art form because they have no third act. They just keep going.
Yeah.
And I told the executive producer that I would really love to learn how to write for the show. So that was a little bit of nepotism, but I had to do a lot of work to get the job.
Sure.
And I ended up as a staff writer for 3 years and was nominated for a Daytime Emmy and a Writers Guild Award as part of the team. So that was fascinating.
Very nice.
It was
what show were you on?
General Hospital.
And oh, really?
Yeah, wow. For 3 years. And then I transitioned over to, they had a half-hour spinoff called Port Charles.
Yeah.
So I did the first 6 months I did. I was on staff.
Uh-huh.
It was fascinating. It was a huge amount of writing. Every 5 days with 2 weeks off.
Wow.
It's great.
So you write, when you write for the entire week or something, or for 2 weeks?
Well, there's a sort of a strata to it all. I was one of the script writers,
uh-huh.
So there were five of us on staff, so we each had a day. I often had Tuesday. And Tuesday is where the story starts moving again. Friday is the cliffhanger to bring people back in on Monday. Monday recaps a little bit from last week, and then Tuesday inches it along.
Right.
And you're typically writing, it's in six acts with a teaser. There's typically about 14 characters on the canvas per show with an A, B, and C story. Mm. And it's like a puzzle that all works together. And there are five of us all over the country who have to sound the same.
Right.
And that's challenging.
Yeah, it is. And you got to stay within the story and everything. Yeah. But do you get to go crazy with it? I mean, do you get to take it like to any direction you want?
No, it's quite the opposite.
Yeah. It is, huh?
Yeah, because it's a big machine that's going every day. And it wouldn't function well otherwise. So each script writer gets an outline. And the outline is pretty specific of what's going to happen in each act. And it has to fit exactly into a certain amount of pages because the taping goes for a certain amount of minutes with a midpoint break for station identification and six commercials. So everything is very exact that you're writing.
I see.
You have to get that outline. That's where the puzzle comes along. You have to have you're working backwards in a way.
Right.
That entire show has to be done in a certain amount of pages.
Right.
Sounds kind of fun.
It's great fun.
Yeah,
it's great
is.
Fun. I loved it. It was so much fun. It was totally different from being a movie executive. I was working at home, for one thing. And, so I was now working in my slippers.
Yeah.
As opposed to wearing a suit. Back in the day, we were wearing suits at the studio. I think it's a little different now.
Yes.
Yeah. Shoulder pads, the whole thing. Yeah. And nylon stockings, something that's gone by the wayside.
Yeah, I know.
When I go on a movie studio, I see young women in flip-flops. I'm like, wow, we could never do that. It was closed-toed shoes and stockings and skirts.
Right.
Wow,
isn't that funny?
It's very different now. I mean, that's also like the same when you go to the theater. People are very casual.
Yeah, the symphony. It's amazing to me.
I like when people had to dress up more.
Yeah, it was great. I had a whole closet full of suits. A closet full. But a lot because I had to wear them every single day with buttoned-up shirts, blouses. But that's back in the day when feminism meant emulating men.
Right.
I think post-feminism is be who you are, which is, we laid the groundwork and your generation has taken it into a whole new realm that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, I know. So, this is exciting. So, now, and who wrote the outlines? Is that like the
outline writers?
There's outline writers.
Yes, and they work with the head writer and the executive producer and the network, and then it's filtered down to the script writers.
Right. So as far as the direction of the show, that takes place at the top.
Yes.
Right.
Or always, as shows do.
Always.
No, I had very little say. For the script writer, they might have writer's choice, where you could do an anecdote or decide a piece of the conversation. It would be very, very limited what you can put in, and everything has to fit and match. So the story editors have quite a job ahead. They have to make sure that everything is in sequence and working well, the continuity is right, and even certain words, like one character may use the word, dearth. And another character, and then they say, no, that character would never know that word. So they cross it out and make it something else.
Right.
So the story editors had a huge job. We just wrote the script.
Yeah.
Sounds like a large staff.
It's a well-oiled machine, but everyone has their own task to do. It was fascinating. It was so interesting to do that. So I was on the show for 3 years, and then I started teaching. In between, I was an expert witness in copyright infringement law. I did that for 2 years on a case, which was also fascinating. Everything has to do with writing. Everything I've done in my career is based on
working with writing. Right.
And then the teaching, I teach 5 classes a week now. And I
really?
I just love it. I'm currently teaching at UCLA in the writer's program, teaching the novel. And I have 2 private groups of professional writers. And I'm also working with television writers who are learning to write novels at a nonprofit for them.
Wow, how cool.
Yeah.
We're talking to Lisa Doctor. You guys can follow at lisadoctor.com, and it's spelled pretty much the way it sounds. And she's coming out with a new book, Accidental Poetry. Now, tell us what the book is about.
Surely.
It's funny. A great title.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The reason the title is very meaningful to me because there's an expression that just sets my teeth on edge when people say broken English. I just can't stand that. There's nothing broken when people are learning a new language, and it's a very discouraging, negative term. So to me, the sort of antidote to that is accidental poetry. It's poetic. And I'll just, if I may, just an example right on the front page.
Okay.
This is a someone who was learning English for the first time. When I say it was first year college student, taking it as foreign language, her parents didn't speak English, and said, "The words fall from my mouth, and the man in the bar sweeps them away with his broom." How beautiful is that?
Wow.
Yeah, I love that.
So there's poetry right there, right?
Poetry, and a lot of it is accidental. They didn't mean it to be poetry. I have another line where a young man in one of my classes said, he was writing about his financial situation, and he said, "I see myself in red numbers." Isn't that beautiful? I love that.
Yeah.
So I decided to take 237 of the several hundred writing exercises that I've developed over the years and put them in a book specifically for new speakers of English all over the world, because I've been to Europe so many times working with writers, and I see how much they love it. And I've taught ESL teachers how to use this method, and they love it too. So that's why I put this together. But for now, it hasn't come out yet. A lot of the people buying it are English-speaking writers who want to use the exercises to deepen their characters. Mm. So the book sort of has a dual purpose.
Right.
But it really is framed because the subtitle is Improve Your English Through Creative Writing. So what we're trying to do now is really get it out there to ESL schools, not as an alternative method, but one that would augment what, you know, traditional learning. So it's not taking the place of learning correct grammar. It's saying if you free yourself up and write from the heart, you can have even more confidence as you learn English.
Wow, and that's interesting, you know, because I'm sure, I mean, English for me is a second language as well. And I know that sometimes it's like you think in a different language as well, and you have to condition yourself to think in English as well. Mm-hmm. But I have to agree with you that in order to write, obviously you have to be a good reader. And you know, I think that, I mean, I can see how it helps them with the language, you know, because you become involved with the grammar, with the vocabulary. And and then I also was thinking about the fact that, you know, like foreigners that speak English as a second language, they bring their own culture with them. So mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of proverbs and sayings and stuff that they translate and to us sound like poetry.
Yes.
Right?
The idioms, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. And I tailored the exercises. There's a wide range of material, I mean, subject matter that it covers. But I also wanted to put in a lot of exercises in the book that deal with compassion and empathy and forgiveness, because it is going out around the world, and it's just, you know, my small contribution to have people understand each other better.
Right.
And really write what's important to them.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's... That's about it. You're giving them, I think, the tools that they need in order to express themselves.
Yes.
Yeah. Very cool. So so you teach.
I do.
At UCLA, right?
Yes, that's one of my teaching jobs.
Okay. Where else do you teach?
Well, the workshops that I do with television writers, it's called TV Writers Fund for the Future, and I'm working with marvelous professional writers who want to learn how to write the novel. And then I have two writing groups per week at my home for professional novelists and memoirists. And I've been doing that for 12 years.
Really?
And it's just glorious. I love doing it.
Amazing. Yeah. And now I see you have a book, a fiction book, called The Deflowering of Rona Lipschitz.
Yes. That was my way of dealing with having to write the voices of the characters on General Hospital and having no idea who those people were. Did they exist in nature? I don't know. So I thought, I wasn't going to write a novel at that point, but I just wanted to get back to my roots because,
right,
you know, Port Charles is where General Hospital takes place, is a fictional town, supposed to be near Rochester, New York. I don't know if women are wearing feather boas up there in Rochester. I think it's more like wool scarves.
Right.
But I wanted to write the voice of me, you know, native of Queens, New York, so it was written in first person, with the voice that is very sort of germane to who I am and the people that I grew up with.
Yeah. So is this like a romantic novel?
It was. It takes place in the 11 days before a young girl named Rona Lipschitz in Queens. She's 18. It's in 1971 when I was that age, and She's about to get married to Stewie, who she knows she will never love. And instead, she falls in love with a young man a few days before her wedding.
Wow.
What happens. So it had been optioned to be a movie, but, you know, I knew it wouldn't happen because very few books that get optioned actually become films. I knew that from being a movie executive.
Yeah.
So it was exciting at the time. And it didn't happen, and that's okay. I loved writing the book, and I loved hearing from people who enjoyed it, and a lot of people from my old neighborhood. We went home for a reunion, and so many people had read it. It was thrilling. I just loved that they read it, and they liked it, and they saw our neighborhood in it.
That's amazing. Yeah. You see, that's the thing. As a writer, you get feedback from people that I think we're hungry for when we post on Facebook. You know, it's like you want to get the response, and here you get it for a book.
It's great.
And it's different, right?
It's gratifying. It's gratifying. I love getting feedback with everything that I do. When it touches people and it moves them, I'm thrilled. I just did a workshop on Saturday afternoon with 20 writers who I don't know, and it was a character development workshop, and we used the exercises that are in this book.
Uh-huh.
And afterwards, they all bought the book, which was great. And they've told me how much they learned about their characters by using the exercises and how satisfying the experience was. So I was on a high just hearing that.
Yeah.
How can somebody participate in one of your workshops?
Oh, that's a good question. And thanks for asking that, Jen. Well, if I'm teaching at UCLA, it's in the writer's program. But it's limited to 15 students because I'm listening to their stories every week. So I guess you could just contact me through my website, and I do set up workshops when a group of gathers together and say, come in and talk to all of us. I'll do that.
Right.
The workshops at home currently are filled, but that does change from time to time.
Right.
And I'm pleased to say there's often a waiting list for different workships. I get very excited when that happens.
Yeah, except why not say it?
You're in high demand. It's okay.
Yeah,
but then
be
I feel
proud
bad,
of your
though.
Accomplishments.
Thank you for that. But then I feel bad if I can't. I want to work with everybody who wants to work with me.
Right.
I don't want to ever disappoint anybody.
Right. Well, you can't please everybody, you know.
But that is very kind of you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So
they can also buy your book.
They can.
Which is great.
Thank you. And I priced it so that it's a Starbucks kind of, you know, the same price as a cup of coffee and could be an impulsive buy. I'd rather price it low and sell more
very
copies.
Nice, yeah.
I think that's very smart. I don't understand when people want to price it at, like, you know, a $17 book. It's like, well, now you've just chewed away many of your audience.
Right.
Yeah, no, this book has, it's the print version is $6.99.
That's a steal.
Yeah,
thank you. And
it
the
really
kin-
is.
Thank you. The Kindle is $3.99, and it also has about 40 beautiful original drawings by Pam Miyazaki, a very talented artist.
Yeah.
And she did the drawings for the book. So $6.99, it's a good deal.
Very nice. And and the price is right for students as well. And,
yes.
You know, that want to, like, learn about this.
Exactly.
I like the deflowering part of the title. Now, what did you mean by that? Pretty much deflowering, right?
Yes,
a woman.
She was a virgin when the book began.
I see. Well, I'm going to read this. If there's deflowering, I'm there.
That's really funny. And it is fiction. I just want to add that it's a novel. Yeah.
Wow. So you have the so if people are interested in the workshops, go to the website lisadoctor.com.
Mm-hmm.
And so you teach people how to write, pretty much.
I do. I teach them the basics of fiction writing. And with the book coming out, there's been a lot of guest blogs. So I had one that came out yesterday, and that's on the Portland Book Review, on what that blog was, Creating Story Problem. And the one before, I did a blog a couple weeks ago for writersdigest.com on what is a sympathetic character. And people think that a sympathetic character means that we like the character, and that's not true. It means that we understand the character.
Mm.
There's a very big difference.
Yeah.
Because liking is arbitrary, and understanding is something that reaches everybody.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
teach
very
that.
Interesting. You see, and that's the thing. When you write a novel, you write a story, there's so many things to know. It's not just sitting there and writing, right? I mean, you want it to have a structure. You want it to have drama and intention and things like that, right?
Right. Well, you have to have a very clear story problem. And then that's what this new blog is. How do you create a story problem? Because we hear about the inciting incident, but an incident is only an incident. So I can give you an example, which I used in the blog. If on page one of a novel, the CEO of a corporation learns that he's just been fired and he's expected a raise and a promotion, if he says, wow, now I can retire and move to Hawaii, it's not a problem because it doesn't matter to him.
Yeah.
But if he says, my entire life is about this job, and I don't know if I could live anymore. Then, so it's the same incident. He lost his job. Depends on how the character reacts to it. If it's a big deal and he wants to, you know, he can't imagine functioning without the job, it's a story problem. Yeah. If he says, great, I can retire, it's not. So the incident itself is not the issue. It's what does he do?
That's true.
As a result.
And that's what life is about, I think. It's not what happens to you, but how you respond to it.
Exactly.
How you view what is happening to you.
Right.
So it follows, you know, it follows
Precisely.
Reality.
And that's what carries the story. Once we set up the story problem and it's clear, it runs as subtext throughout it, and then we watch the character's journey. So what story means is the character's journey. That's why we read
right.
a book.
Yeah.
When we put a book down, it's because we're not really connected to that character.
Right.
So what these exercises do when they're not helping to teach English is to have the writer connect to their protagonist. So that's how I've always used the exercises, and I continue to, and I have hundreds of them, and I'm always creating new ones all the time.
Right. Wow, very cool. Lisa Doctor, everybody, check out her books. We're almost done. We have a few more minutes.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. If you guys want to sign up for workshops that are still available, you can go to the website, and there's a list there of, like before you begin the novel, 10 exercises to get you started. Now, that's a great thing because, you know, I've often thought, I mean, I'm a big reader. I love to read. Mm. And I'm a good writer, too, but I don't have the patience to sit and write. And I think as far as like a book, it seems like an insurmountable task to write a novel from beginning to end, right?
It is. In fact, I often tell writers when I start a new workshop that I spend more money on business cards, giving them out to people, and then I never hear from them because they say, yeah, I want to write a novel. I meet people all over the place. I would love to write a novel. And then they realize that they're going to be writing 90,000 words
wow.
that have to make sense
yeah.
and hold a reader's attention from beginning to end. And they say, maybe I'll do a short story or a poem instead.
Right.
Because it's so the writers who stay with me for years at a time, and many in my workshops, especially the ones at home, I'll have people stay and do two or three novels, or even one that may take them 3 or 4 or 5 years. They know what the task is all about. And
right.
some people can finish in a year, and that's rare. It's a big deal to write a novel because it doesn't happen in one draft. A few
right.
writers like Stephen King can do it in a draft. John Grisham can do it in a draft.
Because they've written so many, right?
Yeah,
they already
the exceptions.
Know it by heart.
Exactly. And
yeah.
they are the exceptions to the rule. And
right.
But it doesn't happen in the first draft.
Yeah.
At all, ever.
Really? So you have to change it quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. Second draft. I love second draft and working with writers in second draft because we already have the frame of, you know, the entire container is there.
Mm.
And now once we know how it ends, we can go back to the beginning.
Right.
And now work with the material that way.
Right. Wow, this is fascinating stuff. Everybody that wants to find out more, go to Lisa Doctor's website, which is lisadoctor.com. You can find out about the books and the workshops and Lisa herself and everything. And so you're from New York, but you've been here quite a while.
I've been here since 1976.
Since 76,
so I'm
yeah,
sort of a Californian.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not by now, I don't know when you will be,
I don't
right?
know. Well, you know, what's funny is that both of my kids are Californians, and my husband, Ron, doctor, he is a doctor,
uh-huh.
Is a Californian. So they understand my language, but I've never felt completely in step in L.A., people have always said, you talk too fast. I don't understand what you're saying.
Really?
Still.
Well, because you're a New Yorker.
Because you're always a New Yorker.
Right.
Always. And I do miss it, but I love Los Angeles. But I also love New York. And that's sort of that Neil Diamond song. Of,
yeah. Huh?
You know, sort of lost between two shores.
I am, I said, yeah.
Yes.
I know. Okay, well, that's it, Lisa.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you both.
Everybody go out, get the book Accidental Poetry by Lisa Lieberman Doctor. So your husband is Dr. Doctor.
He is.
Wow. There's actually a song, Dr. Doctor.
There are a couple
right?
of songs. There's the Thompson Twins. Yeah,
Thompson Twins.
Yeah, there's a few songs that people will sing to us wherever.
Oh, yeah, there's another one. Doctor.
Yes, give me the news.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
I'm singing on the radio. That's
yeah, I know. Okay, well, everybody, thank you all for listening to us. We appreciate that every day. Lisa, thank you and all the best to you.
Thank you so
Let
much.
Let us
thank
know how the book does and everything, sure. or we'll just
and
follow it on
Amazon.
And
thank you for giving us a copy.
Yeah, we each got our own copy, so that's cool.
I'll sign it for you.
Yes, please.
Oh, great.
All right, everybody, thank you all for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning with Jen, right here on LA Talk Radio.